Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
A revolution from 1979. 31 years ago, Iranians welcomed Ayatollah Khomeini as though he was a messenger from God. The Islamic Revolution was an earthquake for Iran and the world. Today, an aftershock. Iranians take to the streets to support the government of President Ahmadinejad while others are calling for another revolution. Iran's split personality, 31 years after Khomeini. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, February 11th, and with those demonstrations in Tehran on the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, the takeaway really this morning is how much self-examination is going on in this nation so isolated, so surrounded by controversy.
Well, it's hard to examine it from outside because we don't actually know for sure what's going on there. Speaking of that, let's get right to the top stories, which is the top is Iran, a chilling announcement from the president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Iran's president announced this morning Iran is now a nuclear state because it produced its first batch of 20% enriched uranium. That's far below weapons grade, though. The backdrop for his announcement? A sea of government supporters in Tehran, hundreds of thousands strong, cheering and marching through the streets to mark the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Meanwhile, anti-government protesters were out as well. But they are reportedly being attacked by riot police who are firing tear gas to disperse them and paintballs to mark them for arrest.
We managed to reach in Tehran earlier this morning Akbar, who's a resident of the city who does not want us to use his surname. And we asked him just to give us a sense of the feel for what's going on today.
This has been declared a public holiday. This is essentially a government orchestrated venue with thousands of their workers, employees from all around the country converging on Tehran.
And is there any way to know what the opposition demonstrations are like?
The opposition leaders, like Harubi, have advised his followers to stage silent marches because they have no authority, no authorization to march.
That was Akbar characterizing the split personality in Tehran this morning.
In Haiti, Reuters is reporting the American missionaries charged with kidnapping will be released and freed as early as today. No confirmation on that, but the judge in the case is widely expected to rule later today on whether to proceed with a trial. The lawyer for the detained Americans is confident.
I believe that all of them will be free.
Also, there's confusion over the death toll from last month's earthquake. After saying yesterday the total stood at 230,000, Haiti's government released a string of statements putting the toll anywhere from 170,000 to 270,000.
In Washington, the White House is rolling out a positive economic forecast this morning. A report by the Council of Economic Advisers says the nation is likely to average 95,000 more jobs each month this year. And they're about the only ones working in D.C. this morning. That's the sound of a snowblower clearing sidewalks. Washington, Baltimore, and Philadelphia broke their records for most snow in a single winter during yesterday's blizzard. And it's not over yet. Forecasters say another storm could be brewing for next week. The president of the European Union says EU leaders have reached a deal to help Greece with its debt crisis, and that's moving the markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,038, the S&P at 1,068, and the NASDAQ opens at 2147.
The psychiatric community is debating how to relabel many of its mental health illnesses in their manual, and we're asking you, how have labels affected you? What is the power of the label? Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or post that on thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, a revolution in media.
From ABC News.
Good evening. This is a new broadcast in the sense that it is permanent and will continue after the Iran crisis is over.
31 years ago, the Iran crisis created Nightline and started a revolution in media in the United States. 31 years later, there's a media revolution going on in Iran. We'll talk about it in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Take that off! Take that off! Take that off! You're listening there quite literally to the split personality in Iran right now today on the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. We played to you the sound of hundreds of thousands of government, pro-government demonstrators and President Ahmadinejad announcing that his nation is a nuclear nation because it's enriched uranium to 20% in enrichment, 20% pure. There you're hearing the yelling of opposition demonstrators. This is an important day in Tehran, and it may speak volumes about the stability inside Iran. First of all, that Iranian presidential statement that Iran is a nuclear nation because it has enriched uranium to 20%, that's far short of weapons grade, which is 90%. Some would say it maybe is about as significant as Iran announcing it's bought a lot of X-ray machines. But nevertheless, it rattles the world when President Ahmadinejad says such things. Joining us is Stephen Kinzer, the author of All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. He also has a forthcoming book on Iran and the region due out in June called Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Stephen Kinzer, good morning.
Great to be with you, John.
So there's a lot to kind of encapsulate here. A lot has happened this week. The announcement on proceeding with nuclear enrichment by the Iranian government, the announcement of the Iranian government setting death sentences for certain opposition leaders who participated in post-election demonstrations. Can you set all of these in context? Is there a pattern emerging?
First of all, I think the regime has been steadily losing legitimacy to the June election. There's kind of a transition going on from a very interesting kind of blend of democracy and theocracy to a more conventional military dictatorship. I think it's also very important to understand that in Iran, there is a broad feeling that comes from the 1979 revolution, the anniversary of which we're observing today, that revolutions are not good. In 1978 and 79, Iranians of all different beliefs banded together and they overthrew the Shah. Even though they disagreed with each other, they all agreed that whatever comes next, it has to be better. So what happened? They got something worse. They got something more repressive. This has made them very revolution shy. And as long as it's possible to produce change within the system, I think most Iranians would desperately prefer that. Some of them, I think, are now reaching the point that that may not be possible, and that is a turning point.
And yet, ironically, the Iranian government continues to say the revolution, the Islamic revolution from 1979, is continuing. Iran is facing an onslaught of interlopers from the United States and the CIA and external interveners. You know, that theme they're trying to maintain.
The Iranian population is remarkably sophisticated, very tied into the outside world. If the United States begins to become actively involved in this project and starts to embrace the reform movement, and the reform movement begins to seem like a tool or an ally of the United States, Iranians will be aware of this, and I think they will then reject it. However, they don't feel that way yet. I think the United States and the Obama administration have taken a wise course of not trying to become too close to that movement and make it seem like it's an arm of U.S. policy. I think Iranians have sensed that, and that's one of the reasons why this movement has become so popular.
I'm sure you got a twinge of nostalgia there at the top of the hour when we replayed, you know, a clip from the old Nightline, which actually was born, that ABC News program was born in the middle of the Iranian hostage crisis. And really, I think it's fair to say, transformed American media, certainly foreign news coverage on television. There's a similar transformation that's taken place in Iran. Listen to this interview on the BBC with Ahmed Mamarian, who's an Iranian blogger on the power of new media.
It was after the election that they learned that how they lost the game in terms of when it comes to propaganda, how they lost the game to the citizen journalism, to Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and in general, internet.
Stephen Kinzer, do you buy that the media in Iran has transformed just as radically as it did in the United States after 1979?
Yes, and I think there's a particular reason for that in Iran, which is that the other normal avenues for public discussion have been so systematically cut off. Newspapers are being shut down. The public forum is not available to people who are critical of the government. This has combined with the intense interest in the internet and highly sophisticated skills that Iranians have developed to produce a whole network of communication that I think the government is still struggling to keep up with.
Are death sentences against opposition leaders and people who participate in demonstrations going to work here?
this is a very profound step. We had two executions recently, but those were of people that had been arrested before the June election. If they start executing protesters now, I do think, among other things, that may accelerate the rift within the regime, and we may see even more intense rivalries and debates and dissent going on inside the regime, which I think a process that's already well underway.
And oddly enough, the Obama administration has been, you know, pretty quiet on this subject. There were some remarks by the president just the other day. But you've written about this 1953 coup that the CIA orchestrated, you know, quite a while ago. But I'm wondering if you think that as this instability unfolds in Tehran, that there are individuals in the national security establishment who would love to pull some levers that haven't been pulled for a long time and try to intervene on the inside.
Iranians have, as part of their national shared consciousness, a deep sense of resentment at the outside world. They feel that every time Iran has tried to develop over the last 200 years, the outside world has broken in and tried to crush them and stop them. There's a great sense that the outside world doesn't want Iran to progress and develop. As long as this extremely brave and noble democratic movement is widely seen as being a domestic Iranian product, it will continue to have the impact on society that it's having now. For the United States, and perhaps well-meaning, to try to rally that movement and start cheering it on every day from the highest levels of government would be a great mistake, because it would take away the independence and the image of independence that is the greatest asset of that movement.
Well, not to sell Stephen Kinzer books or anything, so all the U.S. can do is really watch and wait while Iran resets. Is that what you're saying?
I think what we can do is be explicit in our support for human rights and our condemnation for violations of human rights. Let's not get into details of what ought to happen in Iran. Let's leave that to Iranians for once.
All right. That's Stephen Kinzer. He's the author of All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. His forthcoming book is Iran Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. It's due out in June. And we're listening to protests in Tehran, on the streets of Tehran, on the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The question is, where does the revolution go from here? And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's continue our look at the stories we're following this morning.
We've just been talking about a big anniversary in Iran. There's also a major one in South Africa, where 20 years ago, Nelson Mandela was released from prison. Former President Mandela, who's 91, is expected to make an appearance later in the day. Here at home, government offices in Washington get the day off again. Federal offices in the capital are closed for a fourth day after more record snowfalls across the Northeast. And Republicans are dismissing a White House report that predicts the U.S. will average 95,000 more jobs each month this year. Republican House Whip Eric Cantor says the Obama administration's report is full of praise for its own failed policies of the past year. The report says the economic stimulus package is responsible for saving or creating about 2 million jobs.
Futures trading is up, and it's expected that Wall Street will have a positive opening. And one of the reasons possibly is this story coming out of Brussels. European leaders meeting in that city have reached an agreement on how to help Greece with its mounting debt crisis. The European Union president said that the European nations would take, quote, determined and coordinated action if necessary to safeguard financial stability in the eurozone. In Haiti, Reuters is reporting that those American missionaries charged with kidnapping will be released and freed as early as today. No official confirmation, but the judge in the case is widely expected to rule later today on whether to proceed with a trial. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. Buzz from Jesus Christ Superstar. No, Google is nipping at the heels of Facebook and Twitter with Buzz, their new social media platform. We'll talk more about that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Couple of news takeouts this morning, and we begin with something you may have missed unless you have a PhD in economics. Finance contributor Louise Story joins us here in the studio. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
So Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke talked to Congress yesterday, and we're used to thinking of the Fed as having, you know, one lever. They can raise interest rates. But he was talking about mechanisms that the Fed can use that are really sophisticated, really complicated, but really important, and they moved the markets yesterday. Explain what he was talking about.
That's right, John. He was talking about this new lever that he got in October 2008. Congress gave him a new tool to control saving and lending in the markets. This is something that is often used in Europe, but not usually used in the U.S. And what this is it's interest on reserves.
The IOR.
Right. Right. And what he said is that he's going to, you know, possibly use that instead of his normal rate, the Fed funds rate. And let me explain the difference. The Fed funds rate, which is what he usually uses,
right,
influences the amount that banks pay each other to borrow from each other. Okay. And this interest on reserves is how much the Fed pays to banks for money they put in reserve at the banks. So the way to think about it is, if you're a consumer, let's say that a bank wants you to save more. They can either charge you more for borrowing,
right,
or they can pay you more to save. And what the Fed usually does is it usually pushes this rate to borrow up. It usually affects the Fed fund rates, making it harder, you know, more expensive for banks to borrow. But instead, they're going to pay banks more to save with them. So that's the different tool they're using. They're going to pay the banks more to save. And the effect it'll have on the economy is, if banks are encouraged to increase their reserves at the Fed because they're paid more by the Fed to save, they'll have less money to lend out to all of us. And that
which
might drive
interest rates.
That's right. Drive up the cost to you.
And that could affect mortgages, mortgage resets, that
mortgages,
sort of thing.
It can affect everything. Consumer borrowing in all different places, as well as business borrowing. So it may have very big impact.
Why was this so sensitive yesterday? It was a big breaking news story, and markets were moving up and down on it. Then people were going, oh, the IOR, what's happening?
Well, it's just very unusual for the Fed to use a new tool. I mean, as I said, they didn't have this until October 2008. People are jittery about, will it work right? Will there be unintended consequences? I don't think that people thought he really explained his logic well for using this as opposed to the normal tool. So people are, it's just another uncertainty. People are wondering how will it work, but, you know, it may turn out that it's a better tool.
And giving a sense of this spigot, it involves pumping trillions of dollars back into the economy if he actually ends up using this lever.
Well, if he uses this lever, it could certainly increase interest rates and encourage banks to save more with the Fed.
Save trillions, right. To finance contributor Louise Story, thanks for helping us out with that.
Now for a quick tech takeout. Yesterday, Google started buzzing. They've launched a new social networking service called Buzz. It lets Gmail users share short status updates, a lot like Twitter, but there's a few pieces of Facebook mixed in there too. Fast Company tech blogger and Wired writer Cliff Kwong has given Buzz a test drive. Cliff, you've tried this out?
Yes, I have. It's pretty easy to use, actually, and pretty intuitive once you start getting elbow deep into it.
So why would Google be interested in trying to move into this Twitter and Facebook model? We just heard reports that Twitter wasn't being used or wasn't very popular among young people.
Well, I think that what they looked at and saw was that the primacy of what they were offering through Gmail, which is like the central point through which you're communicating with all the people that you know, was getting sapped by things like Twitter and Facebook. And, you know, in creating Buzz, they basically have a service that sort of mimics a lot of that functionality and tries to aggregate a lot of that information from Twitter, for example, and to sort of put Gmail's offering right back front and center.
How does this different from, you know, we use GChat here on the show to talk to one another as like an instant messaging service? How is this different from that?
You can think of it as a sort of group-wide instant messaging service in a lot of ways. I mean, it's most similar to Twitter in the sense that, it just allows you to post short messages that are broadcast to anybody that you're connected with. And the only difference with Twitter really being that, you know, it's through your Gmail contacts, and also it allows you a lot of, like, rich media embedding that Twitter doesn't allow you.
Some tech writers are pointing some privacy concerns, though, about this Google Buzz, because it makes it instantly public who your email contacts are. So let's say, just for a journalist, let's say Louise Story has some private contacts or sources. Is everyone going to be able to see who she's emailing?
Well, in theory, it'll allow you to edit that. But, you know, in practice, I think it's going to take people a little bit of getting used to understand what this is, you know, what this new thing that all of a sudden popped up as a tab in their Gmail is. So it could be a concern, but I think probably it's going to be addressed, you know, as people begin to use the service and as Google realizes, you know, what exactly people want from it.
Is Google in danger of trying to take on too much, of trying to diversify their service in too many directions?
I'm not sure if they're in danger, but what I will say is that, you know, they probably need to, you know, at some point slow down and rethink a lot of the things that they're doing, because I think that there's been so much growth in their offerings that, you know, you look back and a lot of them seem sort of hard to use or difficult to look at. You know, and Gmail is kind of an example of that. You know, it hasn't really changed in since it was introduced visually. So I think that they probably need to start refining it and making it better looking and easier to use, just like Twitter or Facebook, which is a big part of the appeal of both of those.
Cliff, before we go, does Google own the word buzz?
There's been fights about that. I believe actually Yahoo introduced a service called Buzz. So no, I don't think they own the word Buzz. And that might be different in terms of branding.
Cliff Kuang blogs about design and tech for Fast Company. He also writes for Wired magazine. Thanks so much. Coming up, the psychiatric community is gathering today to debate new labels for illnesses. We're going to talk about how that debate changes mental health treatment for everybody. But we're also looking for your stories on labels, even if they're not about mental health. Have labels ever helped you? And what is the power of a label? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post your story to thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Psychiatrists are revising their handbook, and it calls up that old adage of whether or not a rose by any other name really does smell as sweet, or whether labels matter. We're going to talk about that in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Tehran is a city of celebrations and clashes this morning as Iran marks the anniversary of its Islamic revolution. Security forces are reportedly firing tear gas to disperse crowds and paintballs to mark protesters for arrest. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of pro-government supporters massed in Tehran's main square, where President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad announced Iran is now a nuclear state because it produced its first batch of 20% enriched uranium that's far below weapons grade. Here at home, the Census Bureau is changing the way inmates are counted. It will now release data on prison populations to states before they redraw legislative districts. States will then be able to decide whether to count the prisoners in the rural regions where the prisons are generally located or count them from the city they originally came from.
Some confusion this morning over that death toll from last month's earthquake that the Haitian government released yesterday. After saying the total stood at 230,000, Haiti's government has released a series of new statements, putting the toll anywhere from 170,000 to 270,000. The leaders of the European Union have offered Greece support this morning with its debt crisis, but there's nothing concrete that we know of, no firm offer of financial aid. Greece is in danger of defaulting on $420 billion worth of debt. And Wall Street is waiting to hear the weekly unemployment report from the Labor Department. Those numbers come out any minute now. Let's check the markets. Asian markets are up. European indices are mixed. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,038. The Nasdaq at 21,47. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
There is a Bible for psychiatrists and psychologists in terms of what they call mental illnesses and disorders, or personality disorders. What are the names for those things, and what are the characteristics of each one? That Bible, that book, is changing. The American Psychiatric Association started unveiling proposals for a revised Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, also known as the DSM. The proposals will be debated, and a DSM-5 is likely to be created by 2013. It'll recategorize some of what counts and what does not count as mental illness, and it's a contentious debate, let me just say. Our next guest is someone who's been in the trenches of revising the DSM. He edited DSM-4 in the early 90s, and he has some criticisms about the proposals for the current manual. Dr. Michael First, a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what are some of these proposals that could actually make serious changes in this manual?
Well, there, as you can imagine, the last book came out in 1994, so there's been a lot of science that has occurred in the past 15 years. So you could imagine that there's justification to make a number of changes. There are different kinds of changes. I think some of the changes are reclassifying disorders that are now to something else. Like one of the changes is they're planning to add a new disorder called temper dysregulation with dysphoria for children that used to be diagnosed as juvenile bipolar disorder. So sometimes you're just getting this, you know, a patient will get a different name for condition than they had before. And then there's some proposals for new disorders which will capture people who were never diagnosed with anything before. And it's those disorders which, to me, create the most concern to make sure that people who don't have a mental disorder aren't caught up in the net of having a diagnosis
labeled
that they really
as.
Don't have. A label, exactly.
You know, this debate calls up criticism that I've already seen in blogs and on the net of people saying, for goodness sake, do you have nothing better to do than to argue over names for a mental illness? All this angst over what you're going to call something.
Well, what you call something has a huge implication. I mean, for certainly the names have treatments associated with them, certain levels of stigma. So the name is extremely important. It's not just simply how many, you know, angels could dance at the head of a pin. It actually makes real life difference for patients' lives, for clinicians.
Well, in the case of this temper dysregulation and dysphoria, it's the difference between Johnny's throwing a tantrum and some actual disease.
Well, the name itself is unfortunate because it makes it sound like it's just Johnny throwing a tantrum. When you actually look at the definition, it's very, very serious. And the fact is these kids are being brought in for treatment. I think the motivation behind that particular proposal is right now these kinds of kids, which are very, very difficult to control, get brought into child psychiatrists. They open up the DSM now. The disorder that looks most like it is bipolar disorder because these kids often are very moody. So they give them the label bipolar disorder. Then they start treating them with drugs that are meant for adult bipolar disorder, creating problems. So the motivation for coming up with a new name is to say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't bipolar disorder. This is, you know, whether this is the greatest name remains to be seen, but it's something different than bipolar disorder, and hopefully you'll look at the child differently and treat the child differently.
We actually got a post from a listener at our website. We've been asking people to call in about the power of labels, and David wrote, I know in the case of ADHD, having a name for my inability to focus gave me a chance in school as a child. The label mattered to the school district, and to have a name and a solution to the disorder gave them the information they needed to give me the respect I required. Thanks to that, I was no longer just a lazy student.
Right, and that's the thing about labels is they have a plus side and a minus side. I think your listener really pointed out generally what's considered to be the positive side. The negative side is the stigma associated with it. There are groups like the transgender community is trying to get gender identity disorder out of the DSM because they find that the label is something which causes discrimination and says these people are crazy when in fact a number of people in the transgender community feel this is a variant of normality the way homosexuality is viewed. So the label can actually, it's a double-edged sword. You know, sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's negative.
Well, let's go to someone now who deals with this double-edged sword all the time. Susan Resko is the executive director of the Child and Adolescent Bipolar Foundation, and she has a 16-year-old son with bipolar disorder. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
So you heard us, the doctor discussing the new temper dysfunction disorder in replacement in certain cases for kids who have been labeled with bipolar disorder in the past. Do you see these changes as a good thing?
I do. I agree with Dr. Furtz on a lot of points. There's been a lot of debate about whether bipolar disorder can exist in childhood, and I don't think that this rules this out, but it gives another category for kids that don't fit exactly into this criteria, and a lot of people refer to these kids as diagnostically homeless. But the important point, and I agree with Dr. First, is that it's not just a temper tantrum. These kids are severely ill. They cannot function at home or at school, and this disorder, whatever we call it, is ruining lives.
Do you think that labels matter to the extent that, have you seen in your son's case at least, that what his illness is called has changed the way people treat him?
Well, certainly at the school. He's received a lot of accommodations as a result of the label, and deservedly so. It's allowed him to function. The label temper I'm not really thrilled with because I think it will be caught up in 30-second sound bites by the media as kids throwing temper tantrums, but it's much more than that. So there's a lot of questions still remain to be answered, but this is one possible solution to a large group of kids that don't fit the bipolar criteria.
That's Susan Resko. She's the executive director of the Child and Adolescent Bipolar Foundation. Dr. Michael First, let me ask you, you have some criticisms about the process. Is it about the process?
Well, it's more my concern about some of the new disorders that are being proposed. They have the potential to diagnose people who, first of all, have never had a diagnosis before, which is sometimes good because they come for help, but it also has the potential of mislabeling people. The one that concerns me the most is something called the psychotic risk syndrome. It's trying to identify teenagers at risk for schizophrenia. That's a very laudable goal, because if you could intervene early, that you might be able to prevent it, but there is no effective intervention. And the way it's defined, it has the potential of mislabeling millions of teenagers.
Dr. Michael First is a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University. He also edited the DSM-IV, the manual that precedes the one they're working on now. And we're looking for you for your stories on labels. What is the power of a label? Meredith posts on our site, in researching our son's sensory integration disorder, we realized my husband has also been living with SID, putting a name on his extra sensitive hearing and his aversion to even mildly spicy food has made me more tolerant of him and less apt to label him as a royal pain.
That's
give us your story at
8778
My Take, or post it at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and we're saying goodbye this morning to Good Time Charlie, one of the great wheelers and dealers ever to be in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Alfred Harold Holt, the keys to the safe, okay? I stood there in the office in Islamabad, and I said, how much do you need? And I was apparently annoying him.
That's Tom Hanks immortalizing Democratic Texas Congressman Charlie Wilson in the movie Charlie Wilson's War. Charlie Wilson died yesterday at age 76. Joining us now is CIA operative Mike Scheuer, who knew Charlie Wilson, worked with him for a period of years. Mike Scheuer, what was Charlie Wilson's war? On the battlefield or with his own personal demons?
Well, I think we all have our personal demons, but the war I know about and was reflected in the book and the movie was the war that drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
I mean, he was really responsible single-handedly, in some accounts, of bringing the Reagan administration into the table to finance the opposition in Afghanistan against the Soviet invasion. How did you observe his tactics, Charlie Wilson's?
Well, I think it's a little more than that, sir. Wilson was, of course, almost a force of nature within the House. It shows what one man who is determined to do something can really move along a House of 435 people. But he had the great advantage of working in the Congress at the time President Reagan was there, whose intention was to destroy the Soviet Union. And, of course, Charlie Wilson, the driving force behind the Afghan covert program to support the Mujahideen was to sap the Soviet Union of its soldiers and its economy. There wasn't any real democratic nation-building endeavor going on there. And Mr. Wilson had a lot of Vietnam veterans in the House at the time, and so he had a constituency for doing that.
And it was really motivated by principle. It wasn't because he had, you know, some sort of military procurement contract in his district. Here he is back in 1988 on CBS's 60 Minutes.
I have a very fortunate position in the Congress because I'm on the Defense Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee, and I don't have any military bases in my district. And I don't have any defense contractors.
Where did these principles come from, Mike Scheuer?
Well, he was a flyer. As I recall, he was a Naval Academy graduate, and he had fought in Vietnam. And they wanted to exact a pound of flesh from the Soviets for the Soviet support for the North Vietnamese during the war in Vietnam. And I think he also was, in many senses, a romantic man, a man who saw himself almost like an Errol Flynn.
Indeed.
And the Afghans, some of the Afghans he dealt with were very similar. They were tough guys. They were people who believed in what they were doing, and they really meshed with Mr. Wilson's personality.
The late congressman has referred to this himself, but do you think his activities laid the groundwork for Al-Qaeda and for, you know, what we now know as the war on terrorism?
No, I think there's very few things you do in life that only has one repercussion. Afghanistan was aimed at the Soviets. It had a very good effect on driving the Soviets under. What happened since then, it was a bit predictable, but of course, it could have been nipped in the bud at any place along the line almost from 1992 when the Afghan communists collapsed until 9/11.
Right. And as you say, there was no democratic nation building at all in the Afghan program. Mike Scheuer, thanks so much. Remembering Democratic Texas Congressman Charlie Wilson, Mike Scheuer was the chief of the Bin Laden unit at the Counterterrorist Center from 1996 to 1999. He resigned from the CIA in 2004. Thanks so much, Mike.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. Would you like to improve weather forecasting? Well, you can actually be a weather sensor, or at least make your car into one. Would that actually work to help predict blizzards like the ones we're experiencing here in the East and Midwest? More about that in just a few moments. We also talked earlier about the psychiatric community gathering today to debate new illnesses. It got us thinking about medical labels. We're looking for stories of labels, mental health or otherwise. What is the power of a label?
Labels can be damaging. This is Vinny from Queens. I went to Catholic school, and when I was in the first grade, they broke up us into groups. There were swans, there were chicks, and there were cows. The swans were the smart ones, the chicks had the potential to be smart, and the cows were hopeless. With that label, it ruined my entire academic career. It was only many years later when I jumped back into college and was able to throw that label away that I have a successful academic career. So labels are damaging.
Call us with your story, 877-8MY-TAKE, or post it at thetakeaway.org. Let's check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. In the past few minutes, we have the latest jobless figures. First-time jobless claims dropped by more than expected to 440,000 last week. That news comes as the White House puts out a report saying an average of about 100,000 jobs will be created every month this year, they're forecasting. Republicans are dismissing the White House report. House Whip Eric Cantor says the Obama administration report is full of, quote, praise for its own failed policies of the last year.
European leaders meeting in Brussels have reached an agreement on how to help Greece with its debt crisis. The European Union president said they'll take determined and coordinated action if necessary to safeguard financial stability in the Eurozone. But how will this affect us here in America? For the answer, let's turn to our friend and Newsweek columnist Dan Gross. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
So how is this possible bailout for Greece going to affect us here in the States?
Well, directly, very little. I mean, the big impact of this crisis, you know, Greece is a very small economy. It's only 2 or 3% of the whole Eurozone. But what we've seen happen as a result of this is the dollar has gained strength against the euro. This speaks to weakness in the Eurozone and the European Monetary Union. So if you're going to planning a trip to Europe, you're going to find yourself with a little more buying power. The other area where this has a direct effect, the euro getting weaker, and also these are indications that Greece and other countries in Europe have to tighten their belt, cut their wages, basically consume less. That means that these markets will be less robust for our exports, and so we will probably be exporting a little less to Europe going forward.
Should we be worried about a secondary recession in Europe?
Well, look, you know, in normal times, Europe always grows more slowly than the U.S. That is one of the fundamental differences, right? They trade off stability and a better safety net for slower growth. Of course, they are now having the worst of both worlds, which is slow growth and a period of less stability and a sense that they are going to have to cut back on some of their safety nets. The price of Greece getting aid and then Spain and Portugal, and then people say Italy down the road. These are all countries in the southern part of Europe with very high levels of debt, with dysfunctional political systems, with large sort of gray areas of the economy where they don't cut taxes. They are all going to have to cut back on public wages, public pensions, things like that.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Dan Gross is a columnist for Newsweek. Plows are out in full force on the East Coast to clear away snow left behind by back-to-back blizzards. Thousands remain in the dark, though, after the storms that have contributed to Philadelphia and Washington, D.C.'s snowiest winters on record. In Haiti, 10 American missionaries facing kidnapping charges could know more about their fate today. A defense attorney says the judge deciding whether to try the Americans for attempting to take children out of the country is probably ready to make his ruling today. And finally, in medical news, scientists have found genes that could explain why some people stutter. Research in the New England Journal of Medicine says it's down to gene mutation. Stuttering tends to run in families, so this latest research backs up that theory. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
So for our tech segment this morning, as much of the nation digs out from another blizzard, we note that some of the most sophisticated supercomputers and most sophisticated software algorithms are devoted to the prediction of weather and creating weather forecasts, modeling weather patterns and weather behavior. Joining us now is Dr. Sheldon Drobot, Science Program Manager at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. How are you?
So I'm doing great. And, you know, I always think about this, so that, you know, we always say that the computer information is only good as the data that goes into the computers. And weather models are dependent on weather sensors. And you're considering and thinking about the idea that actually we could vastly improve and increase the number of weather sensors out there if we just put sensors on people, on people's cars, on maybe their windshields to determine what's going on moment to moment, street by street, maybe even square yard by square yard. Is this practical?
It absolutely is. And I think the concept here is pretty simple. So a lot of the vehicles today are providing drivers with information such as the outside air temperature, and all fuel injection vehicles monitor atmospheric pressure. But if you really think about it, there's a lot of other aspects on the car that's providing us with some indirect weather information. So, for example, the wiper status can tell us something about how hard it's raining. The anti-lock brakes can tell us something about whether the road is slick. And our work really involves just gathering this information, combining it with more traditional weather data, and then providing drivers with an assessment of what is going on around them and where they're going. And in other words, a lot of the stuff is already on the vehicle.
It's all about screening out errors, too, though, because sometimes the windshield wipers are on because, you know, somebody threw an egg at the car, or perhaps, you know, somebody's using their windshield wiper fluid. You know, there could be other reasons for the brakes doing what they do. How do you do that?
There's two ways, really. So in terms of the wipers, there are some codes on the vehicle that will tell us whether they're on intermittent or high or low, or whether, in fact, they're on the windshield washer setting. But the other great advantage about the cars is that there's so many of them out there that you're not relying on one specific observation from a specific vehicle. You group it all together, and you get thousands of observations in a very short amount of time over a very short space. So you can begin to really understand what's going on based on that massive amount of vehicles.
Sort of writ large, this whole project has a name. It's called IntelliDrive. And I'm wondering if there are other applications for a massive mobilization of car-related data, cars essentially communicating with all kinds of social networks, that could change our modeling and our forecasts and our picture of other things that go on in society.
Yeah, by all means. And so what we focus on here is weather, but really this program is much bigger than that. And let me give you a few numbers that sort of, I think, point out some of this. So back in 2008, there was about 37,000 people actually that died, and over 2 million were injured on the U.S. roadways, and about 7,400 of those fatalities were associated with adverse weather. And those are big, scary numbers, but they're actually not just numbers to me. So these are our brothers and sisters and our husbands and wives and girlfriends. And with Valentine's Day in a few days, I really want everyone listening to be celebrating in peace and love and not facing grief and sorrow. And I think IntelliDrive will enhance the safety and quality of life for all Americans. It's about using everything we can on the car to get people home safer, faster, and all the while helping to reduce the environmental impact of surface transportation. So I'd say this is really revolutionary stuff. And today we can really only see the tip of the iceberg for what this can become.
Huh. You are kind of like a software love hippie, Dr. Sheldon Drumbaugh. I love that. Finally, you know, in mathematics, I learned that if you increase the number of sensors, the number of data points, that while you do come close to a more accurate model, you also run the tendency or run the risk of creating a much more unstable model that behaves in ways that are as unpredictable as reality itself. How do you deal with that?
That's a really good question. I think that's where some of the research comes in. So one of the things we know in the U.S. is we already have this great, fantastic weather network, but there's really a lot of big gaps still, and especially in the western states. And I think the vehicles will be able to fill those gaps. And that's really important in the weather model sense, because with more and better information on what is happening now, we've done some research that shows that actually it will lead to improved forecasts, not just in the next several hours, but actually for the next several days. So a big part of it is doing some quality control on the observations. But once we're fairly confident in them, then we seem to think that they're going to improve the models.
Thank you, Dr. Sheldon Drumbaugh, a science program manager at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, turning us all into weather sensors.
If you want to find out what's coming up on the next day's show, you can keep up to date at the Takeaway blog. You can also weigh in with your suggestions for stories. Find that at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, we're looking for your ideas on who's having a good week and a bad week. We team up with our friends at The Week magazine every Friday, and we need nominations from you. Susanna in week, and South Carolina has a popular nomination. She's nominating Jenny Sanford, South Carolina's soon-to-be ex-First Lady, as someone having a good week. Her tell-all book, Susanna Writes, just came out, and she's making the rounds of talk shows, getting a lot of sympathy. On the flip side, I guess Governor Mark Sanford probably not having such a good week. If you have ideas on who's having a good or bad week, let us know at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
You know, I think we should put good week, bad week censors on all of our listeners. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
20 years ago today, Nelson Mandela walked out of prison a free man after nearly three decades in captivity.
After 27 years in South African jails, Nelson Mandela is a free man. At 2:15 today, our time, he walked from the gates of Witwatersrand prison, hand in hand with his wife, Winnie.
Not just a day of celebration for South Africans, but for the world.
I greet you all in the name of peace, democracy, and freedom for all.
The man called South Africa's Washington and Lincoln rolled into one. The National Liberator was liberated 20 years ago today. We celebrate Nelson Mandela on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 11th, and the takeaway is how many times has a government made a hero out of someone by throwing them into jail?
Yes, indeed. And of course, the legacy of Nelson Mandela is huge. They still call him Madiba in South Africa. Speaking of anniversaries, let's get right to the headlines this morning. It's the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and Iran's president marked it with a chilling announcement. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad declared that Iran is now a nuclear state because it's produced its first batch of 20% enriched uranium. His backdrop for that announcement? Sea of government supporters in Tehran, hundreds of thousands strong, approved the announcement. Meanwhile, anti-government protesters were attacked by riot police who fired tear gas to disperse them and paintballs to mark them for arrest. Earlier, we spoke to a citizen of Tehran, Akbar, who didn't want us to use his full name. He told us the government has clamped down on all forms of media.
Absolutely every sound that is made is registered by the government. It's an absolute police state.
Today's rallies come hours after President Obama placed new sanctions on Iran, specifically its Revolutionary Guard.
Here at home, the number of newly laid off workers seeking unemployment benefits fell sharply last week, a hopeful sign the job market may be improving. The Labor Department says first-time claims for unemployment insurance dropped by 43,000 to a seasonally adjusted 440,000. It's going to be a while, though, until all the jobs lost in the Great Recession come back. We're joined now by Donald Jones. He's unemployed for the first time at age 60, used to sell photographic equipment before he was laid off. Donald, how long have you been unemployed?
It's going on about a year and a half now.
Have you found that the long-term unemployment has affected you in some surprising ways?
You know, I think your job is such a huge part of your identity, and you're used to being a provider for your family, and you sort of feel an isolation, even though in Detroit you're not exactly isolated when you're unemployed, but you still feel as though you're kind of on the outside looking in.
We're going to explore that more with you, Donald Jones. Stay with us. In Haiti, Reuters is reporting the American missionaries charged with kidnapping children will be released and freed as early as today. No confirmation on that, but the judge in the case is expected to rule on whether to proceed with a trial.
And as they're shoveling snow all over the East and Midwest, let's take a look at the markets. Asian markets are up. European indices are mixed. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway in about a half hour at 10,038. The S&P opens at 1,068, and the NASDAQ opens at 2147. Coming up, We'll talk with some participants in tonight's broadcast of the White House series of civil rights music. Members of the Howard University Choir join us later this hour.
We're also talking about the psychiatric community. They're gathering today to talk about new labels for illnesses. Sometimes having a name for an illness can be a big step for patients in getting help. What's the power of a label? Chana is 17 years old, post to our site. The label of diabetes accentuates the negatives of being labeled. When my high school class took a trip to New York, I was stuck with a school nurse as a chaperone who forced me to eat far more than I knew was good for me. Give us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it on the site, thetakeaway.org.
Our most urgent task is job creation.
This is a very tough economy.
20,000 jobs were lost last month.
And it's probably going to rise further before it starts to come down again.
So when I feel 10, 8, I don't know. I just know I'm unemployed.
Jobs. We need jobs. I don't have kids. My husband and I don't own a home. We need jobs.
It takes some time for jobs to get created again.
Positive news out this morning. The number of newly laid off workers seeking unemployment benefits fell sharply last week as the number of those collecting unemployment for more than a week fell to its lowest level in more than a year. But still, the numbers in terms of long-term unemployment are stark. There are 6 unemployed people in the United States for every job that's available. That's a record high. And another record high is the time that people remain unemployed. It's now at 31 weeks, the highest it's been since we started keeping those records. We're joined now by Donald Jones. He's a 60-year-old who's been unemployed for a year and a half. Donald, the thing that fascinates me about your story is you grew up with a grandfather who lost his job during the Great Depression, and he would tell you stories about how you should never take things for granted.
Exactly. We were sort of brought up in a security type of thing where we didn't have to worry about it. You know, there was things taken for granted, I think, and he used to tell me stories. Actually, the grandfather on the one side of the family was brought up through the General Motors Corporation, so they put him through law school, and I think he got through it relatively unscathed, but on my mother's side, he was the beneficiary of the WPA program, so that he found work when the government came through with some money to repair the roads and whatnot.
Did you ever think that at age 60 you would be back in the same place that your grandfather was?
No, I never thought in a million years that I would. Like I said, we were sort of coming up thinking that things were secure, and we felt, you know, that there was going to be work in what we did. If you did a good job and stuff, and that you would have some form of security.
Let's talk now to Hashim Yeomans-Benford. He's a community organizer with the Miami Workers Center. It's a nonprofit that promotes racial and economic justice. Hashim, you work with minority communities in Miami. Have you seen the same people coming in month after month after month looking for services?
Yeah, I think the number has definitely increased. And, you know, what we've seen in our community is a problem go from bad to worse. Because really in working communities and in communities of color, we've been in a recession for the last 30 years in reality. And so the recent spike in unemployment and the recent housing crisis have really turned that recession into a depression.
Well, how have you seen people's maybe demeanor or their attitudes change as the months go on and they remain unemployed? Do they begin to lose some sense of hope, or as Donald was talking about earlier, do they begin to lose some of their identity?
Yeah, I think definitely unemployment, when you talk about unemployment, we have to realize that it has a very destabilizing effect in people's lives. And so we see it affect people at the individual level. We have a family that is a part of our organization. The mother and the father worked and paid bills for many years, but the types of jobs that are often available in our communities offer little job security and no benefits. So in 2008, they lost their jobs. They were forced to move in with some relatives. That home ultimately went into foreclosure. And what happens is that kind of kicks off a cycle that's very hard to get out of, because it's very hard to have a job when you don't have a stable home. It's hard to find work. And then it has psychological impacts on the children. And so in communities where unemployment is very high, this destabilizing effect in individual homes turns into the destabilization of the community as a whole, which has pretty big political impacts as people are forced to move. So it changes the dynamics of electorates. And as more and more communities become destabilized, we start having a national crisis, and it actually becomes a national security question.
So, Donald Jones, we have a recording of a song. This is a song that you wrote back in 1980, which was another economic downturn, but it suddenly had new meaning for you after you lost your job.
Bank man, text man, got me on the run. Money's all gone, so is all my fun. Can't find a job, nowhere to be free. Better not mess with my dignity.
Better not mess with my dignity. You know, Donald, this can be a sensitive subject, but for people who experience long-term unemployment, there are psychological issues that are associated with that. Losing your dignity, you talked about losing your sense of identity, and there's also senses of isolation and depression that come along when you go week after week, month after month without a job.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You start to look at your self-worth, and it really does take a beating. You go places like the grocery store or whatever, and there's people working, and it might be a place that you applied for where you haven't been able to get a job there, and you think, well, I'm out here and there. It does start to take a hit on you. I think it really helps, like the gentleman said that you were just talking to get politically active. We have things in Detroit here where we fight against the foreclosure. We have the People's Summit and places like that, and I think it helps to get out and try to make a difference in it. It does make a difference if you get involved, and it gets rid of some of the anger, too.
That's Donald Jones. Hashim, you're hearing Donald Jones from Detroit, a 60-year-old, and he's been unemployed for a year and a half. You, in your work with the community organization in Miami, must see people like that all the time. Do you have people that come in needing reassurance? Are they questioning their own self-worth?
I think more than anything, what happens is people become disillusioned with a lot of the stories we're told about what this country is supposed to be and what opportunity is supposed to look like. And, the role of an organization like ours, and, there's many of us across the country that do this work, is to try to organize those people and put pressure on the state to provide the type of solutions that are actually going to address the deeper systemic issues behind this unemployment. So to try to take those psychological questionings and the anger and try to focus that to get politically active, like Don said, and actually get some real solutions implemented.
Hashim Yeomans Benford is a community organizer with the Miami Workers Center. It's a local nonprofit in Miami that promotes racial and economic justice. Donald Jones is unemployed for the first time at age 60. He used to sell photographic equipment until he got laid off. He joined us from Detroit. He's also one of our listeners who originally called us with his story back in November. And we're always anxious to hear your stories. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or give us your story at thetakeaway.org. And it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
Those back-to-back blizzards in the Mid-Atlantic region have more than tens of thousands of people remaining in the dark. 100,000 utility customers in Pennsylvania were left without power. Some never got it back after the last storm, and the lights are still out for thousands in Delaware. Foreclosures for last month are down 10% in the U.S. compared to December. 315,000 homeowners were sent foreclosure notices in January. The improved month-to-month figure is still 15% higher than the same time last year. Reuters is reporting the American missionaries in Haiti charged with kidnapping will be released and freed as early as today. There's no official confirmation on that, but the judge in the case is expected to rule on whether to proceed with a trial.
In Iraq, hundreds of private security guards have been told to leave the country by the end of this week. The guards are linked to the security company Blackwater Worldwide. The order comes after a U.S. judge dismissed criminal charges against five Blackwater guards accused of shooting 17 people in Baghdad in 2007. And there's a party atmosphere in South Africa today. That's the sound of singing in Cape Town as South Africans mark the 20th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison. Former President Mandela, who's 91 years old, is expected to make an appearance later in the day. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, it's nearly a month since Haiti was hit by a devastating earthquake, and the UN chief responsible for coordinating all the relief efforts from around the world finally tracked him down. He had a moment to speak with us, and we'll talk to him in a moment.
We're also going to talk about Mandela 20 years after his freedom later on in the program.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout comes from Haiti, and we welcome an individual who we've been trying to reach for quite some time since the Haitian earthquake, but who for very obvious reasons has been pretty darn busy down there in Port-au-Prince. Shane Gilbert joins us, chief of the Joint Operations and Tasking Center for the United Nations in Haiti. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, John.
So, you know, the UN was one of the big victims right after the earthquake. I mean, you arrived in the country, and not only was the nation devastated, but UN operations were devastated. How did you begin to pick up the pieces when you arrived 5 days after the earthquake?
Well, a fairly traumatic experience. As you mentioned, we lost about over 40 of our staff, including our senior leadership. So the first thing we had to do was we brought down some senior people from UN headquarters in New York, and we just started picking up the pieces. So it was very almost like a combat zone down here.
We're familiar with the face of the United Nations as a kind of a thoughtful, diplomatic, maybe sometimes a slightly wordy character on the world stage. You are the other face of the UN that actually gets things done, that mobilizes the kind of action end of the United Nations. What kinds of things did you have to do, and how different are you from those sober, sometimes boring speeches in the Security Council?
Yes, I've worked at both ends of the spectrum. Of course, in this situation, we're dealing with a number of member states and the host country itself, and we all share the same purpose, and that makes it a lot easier for us to act. Because we do share the same purpose, everyone was willing to work out how best we could work together. So in our role here in the JOTC, for example, all we did is we provided the opportunity for all of those member states and organizations to come together to be able to share the information that we could possibly gather, and then work with the humanitarian community to try and meet their needs that they couldn't deliver themselves. So that worked fairly well. The only difficult part, I guess, was just ensuring that we all knew how we would talk to each other and what procedures we would follow so that we wouldn't step on each other's toes. So that took a little while to do, but we got there.
Shane told us this morning that it started raining in Haiti today, and the challenge of getting new shelter to the refugees is what his top job is right now. Shane Gilbert, Chief of Joint Operations in the Tasking Center for the United Nations in Haiti.
And now for an update on Asian carp. The federal government has crafted an almost $80 million battle plan to fight off Asian carp in the Great Lakes. Joining us is Nathan Hurst. He's the Washington correspondent for the Detroit News. Nathan, what is this $80 million supposed to pay for?
It's going toward a number of carp fighting efforts, including a limited closure of the locks in Chicago that connect the Lake Michigan basin to Mississippi River, and also some controlled poisoning efforts and an installation of new barriers to keep the fish out of Lake Michigan.
Well, the Governor Granholm of Michigan has said that $80 million is not nearly enough to deal with the problem.
Well, and you know, she's got some good statistics to back it up. The state surrounding the Great Lakes spend well over $100 million a year battling lamprey eels and also zebra mussels, which are other very harmful invasive species on the Great Lakes. It's quite an expensive effort once an actual invasion has occurred.
You know, people who may not know much about this story would wonder what the big fuss is about whether or not these fish get into the Great Lakes, but scientists tell us that this is a crisis in the making should these fish pass by Chicago and head into the Great Lakes.
They're best described as very, very hungry fish, and they sift plankton out of the water and are basically able to sift out all of the food that any other aquatic life would eat before they're able to get to it. So they very quickly take over an ecosystem, and it is considered at a very red alert crisis level kind of deal.
And there's also a lawsuit pending filed by the Michigan State Attorney General, but also there's four other states that are in that lawsuit. What's the status on the suit against the government?
Right now, nothing has happened with it. It was rejected by the court, and then it was refiled. So we're still waiting to hear back on that, but they will be pushing forward pretty heavy on that lawsuit.
Okay, Nathan Hurst is the Washington correspondent for the Detroit News.
Our last takeout consists of some snow day memories from you.
It was 1947. I lived in New York City at the time, and up until that time, we had never had a snowstorm like that before.
That's Annette in Montclair, New Jersey, talking about a snowstorm memory that we asked you to deliver to us at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Annette went on.
And with dozens and dozens of kids, we threw snowballs at each other. We rolled in the snow. We were so upbeat. We were so happy. In those days, schools did not close on snow days because everyone was able to walk to their local school. It was a glorious time.
More memories from Patty. She posts on our website, thetakeaway.org. She says, growing up in Western Washington State, I remember the smell of oatmeal being made and the radio on with the farm report playing. And then the announcement would come that schools were closed. My three brothers and I would cheer and carry on until my mom told us to go outside. We'd sled, build massive snow forts complete with candles for warmth and light. We'd stay out until our skin started to itch from the cold.
Oh, I can feel that.
Then it was inside for hours and hours of ping pong, the best when we knew we'd be out for days, and then you could relax and enjoy it.
Elle here had a good one. She sent it to our website. To get a snow day, the wind chill had to be 30 degrees below zero, the kind of cold that burns the inside of your nose the second you step outside. When that happened, my friends and I were overjoyed to the point that our judgment was impaired. We'd all end up at the ski hill together, bundled beyond recognition. We'd take one run, then rush into the chalet for shelter and hot cocoa. After an hour or so, when we could finally feel our toes again, we'd take another run, then rush back into the chalet. It takes a little insanity and a lot of love for winter to take advantage of a snow day in the, guess where she's from?
The UP.
The UP, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I think those days grew our Youper pride.
Youpers from the
yes,
UP.
Yeah,
I feel kind of jealous of all these snow memories, having grown up near the beach in Southern California. If you have a particularly fond snowy day memory, let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Thanks for sharing.
Coming up, we're going to go back 20 years.
And now Mr. Mandela walks through the gate. He's a free man. I hold this moment.
We remember the 20-year anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release, and look at how the country is celebrating today. The world is celebrating today, actually.
That voice just, you know that voice.
His Nelson Mandela's voice? Absolutely. Yeah, you recognize it immediately.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
So, coming up, it's the 20th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release. We look back at that moment, hear some great voices, and look at today's celebrations, too, in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. You're listening to hundreds of thousands of government supporters in Tehran this morning cheering and marching through the streets to mark the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The man at the podium speaking to those demonstrators is President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He told the crowds that Iran is now a nuclear state because it's produced its first batch of 20% enriched uranium, but it's far below weapons grade. In Afghanistan, U.S. Marines and Taliban fighters exchanged gunfires on the outskirts of Marja, coming to the site of a major attack in the coming days.
New economic numbers out this morning. The number of newly laid off workers seeking unemployment benefits fell sharply last week, a hopeful sign for the job market. The Labor Department says first-time claims for unemployment insurance dropped to 440,000. That's the lowest total in a month. And new foreclosure numbers for January are also out.
We saw a marginal decrease in foreclosure activity in January. It was down about 10% from December. But unfortunately, it was up 15% year over year.
That's RealtyTrack's Rick Sharga saying the foreclosure rate probably won't get better until next year. And the leaders of the European Union have offered Greece support this morning with its debt crisis. There's nothing concrete we know of, no firm offer of financial aid. Greece is in danger of defaulting on its $420 billion debt. Looking at the markets, they're now open. The Dow is down by about 3, the S&P down about 1, and the NASDAQ down also about 3. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Hard to believe it's been 20 years, but 20 years after the dissident leader of the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela, walked free from a South African prison and became one of the most powerful political reformers in modern history. It's worth noting that two of the most acclaimed films released this year are a retelling of the iconic fable of Mandela's rise and the fall of apartheid. This is from the soundtrack of the movie District 9. It's up for a Best Picture Oscar, and it's the retelling of the liberation of the black township Soweto through a story about space aliens, quite literally. And the other film is Invictus, which is a retelling of the victory of the Springbok rugby team after the fall of apartheid, which, along with Nelson Mandela, brought the nation of South Africa together. Here's Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela.
You elected me your leader. Let me lead you now.
Mandela resonates throughout global culture, and 20 years ago today, he was released from prison after 27 years behind bars. Here's his voice speaking in 1990.
You've achieved legendary status during your years in prison, Mr. Mandela. Are you worried about living up to that legendary status?
No. There is no single individual who can undertake the enormous task of solving the problems of this country.
Breathtaking. The sound of that voice so familiar. The man who conducted that interview with Nelson Mandela joins us now, James Robbins. He's now BBC diplomatic correspondent. He joins us from London. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
Also with us is Fatima Mir, a friend and biographer of Nelson Mandela. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Fatima, why do you think Nelson Mandela resonates as such an iconic figure throughout world culture, even today?
It's because he's almost like the blessed figure he had in Mahatma Gandhi. He is one of those rare individuals who, when he came out of prison, it is remarkable that he never in any way...
Well, it certainly is remarkable. Mm-hmm. Fatima Mir is a biographer of Nelson Mandela, the author of Higher Than Hope, and she joins us from Durban, South Africa. What kinds of commemorations are going on around the world, James Robbins?
Well, I think the chief commemoration today is the fact that many ANC leaders, those involved in the release of Nelson Mandela 20 years ago, have gone back to the gates of Victor Verster Prison in the Cape, in the beautiful winelands of the Cape, although it can't have seemed very beautiful to Nelson Mandela coming towards the end of his 27 years in prison. And he will be the guest of honour later on today when his successor, President Jacob Zuma, makes his State of the Nation speech at the end of the day. I mean, I endorse and agree with everything that Fatima Meir was telling us. He is such a remarkable figure because he has absolutely transcended the suffering that he went through, that others went through with him in prison. He came out, of course, committed not just to continuing the struggle for a non-racial South Africa, because let's remind ourselves, 20 years ago, it was certainly not that, and there were long and difficult years of negotiation ahead with the president who released him, President F.W. de Klerk. But Nelson Mandela also came out preaching very strongly the message of forgiveness, which has taken deep root in modern South Africa.
You know, James Robbins, I'm wondering, throughout this last 20 years, Nelson Mandela has maintained his stature, but he's always been a skeptic of his own legacy and his impact on human rights in the world. Those seem to be contradictory, yet his stature has increased throughout these 20 years.
Well, I think he is quintessentially a modest man. I mean, in that little clip of a fragment of the interview that I had with him, I was privileged to have with him within a couple of days of his release back in 1990. I was pretty stunned when I asked him if he would find it hard to live up to his legendary status, and he said the single word no. I was a bit taken aback, but of course he went on to say that it wasn't him who everybody should judge and look to, but his organisation, the African National Congress. And he's always deferred to the idea of the collective will, the collective determination of the people of South Africa to be free. But there's no doubt, frankly, that without his leadership, it would have been very much more difficult to achieve that.
Fatima Mir, a biographer of Nelson Mandela, what do you think the leader in this speech that he's going to give, a State of the Nation speech that he's expected to give today, would say about the next 20 years in South Africa and in his mission for the world?
Well, we are all hoping and helping Rhodesia to recover herself. And I think that Nelson Mandela will still play a very important role there.
And, you know, he is 91. He does seem like he would live forever. Fatima Mir is a friend and biographer of Nelson Mandela. She's the author of Higher Than Hope, a biography of the man who walked out of prison 20 years ago today. James Robbins, a final thought, BBC diplomatic correspondent.
Well, just Nelson Mandela still plays an extraordinarily powerful unifying role in South Africa. And a final thought, I spent some time at the University of Cape Town with young students, 20-year-olds now, either not quite born or just being born when Nelson Mandela came out of prison. And I did that deliberately because for them this is already an event in history, important though it is. And the powerful message that came across from them was one both of great optimism, and we're talking now, of course, about black, white, Indian students, mixed race students on a campus which was predominantly white before Nelson Mandela was released, huge optimism, coupled with, from one of them at least, a doubt about whether the unity of purpose that has guided South Africa through the last 20 years will outlive Nelson Mandela, because they recognize his importance.
Well, 20 years ago, he walked free. James Robbins, BBC diplomatic correspondent in South Africa, remembering Nelson Mandela. And we'll take you to voices of that day 20 years ago when Nelson Mandela walked free.
And now Mr. Mandela walks through the gate. He's a free man out of this moment. He's waving his fist repeatedly in the air. He's smiling. He's a very alert, very imposing-looking figure, slightly graying hair, upright, a beaming Winnie Mandela alongside him. The crowd are responding with their fists raised in the air, too.
Coming up, we talk about tonight's broadcast of the White House series of civil rights music with members of the Howard University Choir later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Heavy winter storms have swept over the Northeast and blanketed the streets from West Virginia all the way to Massachusetts. Our nation's capital has been shut down all week with what has been the snowiest winter in D.C.'s recorded history. Snowstorms make a lot of us think about shoveling or school cancellations, maybe treacherous driving. But according to our next guest, snow has actually been a big part of our culture in this country, and it's played a big part in our history as well. Bernard Mergen is a professor emeritus of American Studies at George Washington University, author of Snow in America and Weather Matters, an American Cultural History Since 1900. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So this goes way beyond somebody telling you to restrict your conversation to your health and the weather, right? You're saying that weather has actually mattered in terms of shaping our American personality.
I believe so. I mean, I wouldn't ever claim that Americans are unique in their perceptions of weather, but every part of the country really has different perceptions based on their expectations, and that's probably the number one way in which weather affects history, is that it creates expectations about the normal, and then it challenges those expectations every once in a while.
Because it's always abnormal. Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, I guess... there are any number of, most recently, of course, is Katrina, because of the expectations of hurricanes along the coast, but when they exceed the expectations, the result is catastrophe and the soul-searching that comes afterward. And so we seem to go through cycles of these. I'm interested in my books in the way, maybe not the big sort of way in which the wind sank the Armada or the iceberg sank the Titanic or something, in the way that weather changes history, but in the way that weather constantly nudges us in certain directions. That is, I'm thinking there was a long time in which the Weather Bureau refused to acknowledge the term tornado. The weather forecasters from 1880s through the 1930s were not supposed to mention tornadoes in their forecasts because there was a fear that they would panic people and the predictions weren't very good. But the great tornadoes in 1925, the so-called tri-state tornado in Missouri, Indiana, and Illinois, which killed between 600 and 900 people, really forced the Weather Bureau to rethink its approach. And again, in 1933, the Navy dirigible, the Akron, crashed in a storm off Atlantic City. And a lot of people blamed the Weather Bureau for being too slow to adopt new methods of forecasting. And so President Roosevelt appointed a very high-level commission, including the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Millikan. And they completely revamped the Weather Bureau in the 30s. So I'm looking at these things that maybe don't make the headlines, but affect the way in which we are dealing with the weather today, because the Weather Bureau has changed to keep up with the times.
And certainly in each region of the country, they have a different view of holidays, whether it be July 4th or Christmas or something else, depending on what the weather looks like out their window. That's Bernard Mergen, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at George Washington University.
He's kind of the Howard Zinn of snow, I think. Historian,
the
social
people's
historian.
History of snow. Yeah.
Yes, I think so.
Snow
think
in
so.
America is his book. He also wrote Weather Matters, an American Cultural History since 1900. Thanks so much, Professor Mergen.
And I brought me some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we talk about the concert at the White House, in which the halls were ringing with the music from the Civil Rights Movement. And we'll speak with two people who sang in the White House from the Howard University Choir.
Are you going to sing? Are you going to sing?
I am not going to sing.
You're not
gonna sing. It's their moment to shine. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The latest jobless figures came out this morning. First-time jobless claims dropped by more than expected to 440,000 last week. The White House has some more positive news on the jobs front. A report from the Council of Economic Advisers says an average of 100,000 more jobs will be created each month this year across the country. The Republican take on the jobs report is more critical. Republican House Whip Eric Cantor says the Obama administration's report is full of, quote, praise for its own failed policies of the past year.
Citigroup has announced a pilot program which will allow homeowners who are about to face foreclosure to stay in their property. They will be allowed to stay in their homes for an extra 6 months rather than face immediate eviction. Tributes are coming in this morning for the former Texas Democratic Congressman Charlie Wilson, who died yesterday. Here he is in 1996 announcing that he was stepping down from Congress.
There is a time for everything, and my internal clock tells me that 36 years in public office is enough.
Speaking about the former congressman, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said he helped, quote, bring the Cold War to a close. Wilson worked to funnel millions of dollars in weapons to Afghan rebels who fought off the Soviet Union. It was an act of bipartisanship that we can scarcely imagine today. Wilson was 76. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
That song, Lord, I Done What You Told Me To Do, resounded through the halls of the White House on Tuesday night. That's the voices of the Howard University Choir. They were part of a White House performance series that's called A Celebration of Music from the Civil Rights Movement. The event included artists like Jennifer Hudson, Bob Dylan, John Legend, and many others. It'll be broadcast on most PBS stations tonight at 8 p.m. And we have two members of the Howard University Choir with us this morning. Good morning to Dr. James Weldon Norris. He's the conductor and director of the choir and a music professor at Howard. And his grandson, Brandon D. Strong, a singer and manager of the choir. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Dr. Norris, you have a long career, but you actually arranged that song that we were just hearing from the Howard University Choir, but it was performed at the White House. How did you write the song, Lord, I Done Done?
Well, you must remember I was raised in South Carolina, and my grandfather was a Baptist minister. So traveling with him throughout my youth, I heard these old church songs sung frequently. So this is an old black church tune that's absolutely just fascinates me every time I would hear it. It would usually be sung often after communion or sometimes at funerals and things like that. And so we were performing one night in Connecticut during the Beethoven Ninth. And on the way back, the bus was quiet. So I took out my music paper and my pen and I started to jot this tune down and do the arrangement. And I'm so glad I did because I just love it very much.
You know, the Howard University Choir, I'm sure they sing a number of spirituals, and the singing of spirituals with university choirs, it doesn't have as long of a history, perhaps, as many people think. Here's a recording of the Fisk Jubilee Singers from 1955. Singers were actually the first choir, really, to bring spirituals into the concert hall. And at the time, it was kind of revolutionary. The singing of spirituals was not entirely accepted by the African-American community.
Well, at this particular time, I don't think it, I don't think that you could say it wasn't accepted by the African-American community, but the time the original Fisk Jubilee Singers did that, it's that most people just didn't get a chance to hear them. The Fisk Jubilee Singers, I happen to have been the beginning, let's say, of the Negro spiritual as a concert art form, and they really made it into one and developed one. It's absolutely fantastic the way they did it. In later years, I think it became somewhat, unpopular, let's say, to sing spirituals on college campuses and things, because we were just going into a new light, and it was very unfortunate.
You kind of wanted to, people felt like you wanted to move on, is that what you mean?
So what now?
The people felt like they should move on from the Negro spiritual tradition?
Yes, they didn't want to sing these old songs, reminded them of old times, they said, you know, one of those things. And it was very unfortunate. But then it began to revive. And with many of the traditional black colleges in America, you know, which were the church-owned, the spiritual began to be popular again. And people began to sing them and have a new respect for them and a new light for them.
Well, let's ask a younger generation, your grandson, Brandon D. Strong, a singer with the Howard University Choir. Brandon, how do you feel about the singing of these, what your grandfather just called, old songs?
Well, for my generation, we can't really relate to the music. However, it does mean something to us. And especially the other night, singing in the White House, you got a sense of the African diaspora, what it means to be the descendants of African Americans, and like a conceptual view of your culture.
But you don't feel a connection when you sing the words. That doesn't make you call up any special connection between you and the songs.
No, ma'am. Honestly, because these songs, most of the time, were used as coping mechanisms, like he said, in funerals. Then you have chain gang songs, and they were songs that represented what was going on at the time. And in my generation, we haven't had to go through struggles in the same right that they have. And our music that speaks through us now is so much different.
Who was you were there, Brandon, singing with a lot of famous performers. Who was the person you're most excited to sing near?
Honestly, Bob Dylan. Being on the same program as Bob Dylan struck a chord with me.
And you left right before Natalie Cole and Jennifer Hudson took the stage, is that right?
We left after Jennifer Hudson and Smokey Robinson sang, but before the Blind Boys of Alabama performed.
Oh, they're great.
Dr. James,
because of the snow.
Oh, yeah, you had to travel out of D.C. before you got stuck there and couldn't get back to Howard University. You know, Dr. James Weldon Norris, it's very difficult for me to not associate your name with the famous civil rights singer James Weldon Johnson. You wouldn't happen to have been named after him, were you?
I was. James Weldon Johnson and my father were fraternity brothers. And so my mother tells me, and he insisted I be named after him.
I was just going to say, Johnson was a teacher at Fisk.
He was a teacher at Fisk, yes. He was a teacher at Fisk, a great writer. And he and his brother, J. Roseman Johnson, were great musicians. And they collaborated quite a bit. So you can see that his writing, Lift Every Voice and Sing, and our performing it often, it means so very, very much to me. Because if you actually dissect that poetry with the surgical scalpel, I call it, you will find that every line is a sermon.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's a magnificent piece of music.
And Lift Every Voice and Sing, often called the African American National Anthem, written by James Weldon Johnson. Thanks to both of you for joining us. James Weldon Norris, director and conductor of Howard University Choir, also a professor of music history there, and his grandson, Brandon D. Strong, singer and manager of the choir. That's one of the songs the choir performed at the White House on Wednesday, arranged by James Weldon Norris. You can hear the whole thing, Lord, I Done What You Told Me To Do, as performed by the Howard University Choir. It's on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Ooh, leave it there. Leave it there. Nice. All right. Now, if you go to the website, we also have a project for you that needs your photos.
God loves a terrier.
Remember, Best in Show? The Westminster Dog Show is coming up next week, and we're having our own dog show. Send us a photo of your four-legged friend, dog, And we'll judge the best in show with our listeners. Post your photos on our Facebook page, and we'll talk about them next week. Get instructions on how to do that at thetakeaway.org. It's you and your dog.
My beagle's going to win.
Takeaway. You have a beagle?
I have a beagle.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to see the picture. We'd love to hear from you on anything in your lives.
My name is Hector, and I'm phoning from New York. I was unemployed for a year. That period was awful for me.
We talked earlier about how long-term unemployment can have disastrous, stressful consequences, and we've been getting stories like Hector's.
And the most crucial aspect of it was it also led to a separation with my spouse, who suffered a tremendous amount because of decisions I was making or not making. My sense of self was down to an all-time low. In fact, I never even knew that I could feel that way about myself. And it led to my separation, and that was awful. And I do apologize to her because she is a great person, and she suffered a lot. But some people can only put up with so much.
And you know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to hear it all. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.